From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last night when Rochester City Council voted overwhelmingly to extend the housing tax break known as 485A. The vote was 8-1 in favor. Only Councilmember Mary Lupien voted against it. We discussed the tax break on Monday on this program, but there were still some unanswered questions. And as numerous listeners have pointed out, we talk about developers quite a lot on this program. We don't talk to developers all that often. That's where Matthew Denker comes in. He's the owner of Labeled Living. He's listened to this conversation on Monday and felt there were some missing pieces. He understands that the tenant union might disagree with some positions. He's heard their perspective numerous times on Connections. But Matt's main concern was a lack of understanding on some of the math. Now, to be clear, I usually promise on this show there will be no math. But this time, Denker says understanding the math is key to understanding this issue in this debate. I also thought it was interesting that Matt expressed affection for both sides of the debate on Monday, and he also a little bit of cringe at both sides. So we decided to sit down, talk through where he sees the public discourse going and sometimes going wrong on these matters. Let's do it. Matthew Denker is the owner of Labeled Living in Rochester. Welcome.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Well, and by the way, I asked for a list of what Labeled Living has done here. You've got new builds on Lamberton, 11 Lamberton Park.
Yep.
170 Atkinson Street. What's there?
That's a single family home. It's actually a finalist for the Reimagining Rochester Awards this year in the small project category.
On what grounds there?
It's a really interesting design. It was also the only owner-occupied market-rate single-family home built in the city last year.
Very interesting. 55 Seacliff Road in Irondequoit, also single-family?
Yep.
Okay. The Towns on Marsh. What's the Towns on Marsh?
It is a 5-townhouse development project on a former parking lot around the corner from St. Monica's, so off of Brooks and Genesee.
And then you also are in charge of the Genesee Block Ice Company. What in the world?
Yes, we're one of two large format ultra clear cocktail ice companies in Rochester, actually. The other one's owned by a great guy, Ralph DiTucci. It's called Cristalino.
I know Ralph DiTucci. Yeah. I didn't know that you were his main competitor.
I feel like we're targeting different parts of the market, but I guess you could call us competitors.
Are you a cocktail drinker?
A little bit. I haven't had one yet today. If that's
okay. No. I was hoping not. And then also crumpets. What's the story on crumpets?
Oh man, you're gonna have me shill all my businesses.
I want people to understand what you've been doing. So when we talk through this, we get a look at your, you know, the kind of work that you're doing.
Sure. So I'm the business half of the crumpet shop over on Monroe Avenue. The other half of it, the operational half, is Evan Netto, who is the crumpet lady, as you. Can tell I'm not the crumpet lady. I know our viewers can't see that, or our listeners can't see that. But it's great. We opened back in April.
I don't even know what a crumpet is.
So it's a cross between, the best way to describe it is a cross between an English muffin and a pancake. It's a griddle cake. So it's done on a griddle. It's cooked on one side and then only flipped for a minute or two.
Is it breakfast?
Yeah.
Is it exclusively breakfast?
We do breakfast and lunch. So we have sweeter options that would be a very American kind of breakfast thing, jam, Nutella, things like that. But we also have more savory options, things with ricotta and tomato and pesto and things like that too.
Okay, so you got your hands in a lot of different ideas and projects here. And you listened on Monday and you sent me a note and there were certain things that rubbed you a little bit the wrong way. So let's kind of take like the 30,000 foot view and then we're going to get a little granular. I joked with Matthew beforehand, we're going to get intentionally boring. It's not going to be boring. I think this matters. This is one of the times where the math matters here. But what bothered you on Monday?
So, and I want to start out explicitly that this is not me coming on here strongly in support of the 485A. I've never received it for any of my projects. I don't have anything in the pipeline that even touches it.
It's one of the reasons why you were allowed on the show today.
Right. and I also am not here with the unflagging support for the tenants union either, although they're great and the work they're doing is important. There's a lot of landlords out there who are untoward, and I think the tenants who are being taken advantage of need real help. So there's a lot of value to what everyone's bringing to the system here. It's just I wanted to come and talk a little bit about the numbers behind all of this and what makes it really really challenging. You know, none of this one of the things, if I recall correctly, that Matt said when he was on the show on Monday was that none of this stuff is a slam dunk. And I think of all of the parts of it that I agree most with, it's that, you know, I don't think he talked about it, and I don't think this is a secret, so hopefully I'm not blowing his cover on the radio show, but he was with, he was with Dutton when they finished and sold off Caprone. He was working with them to make that happen. You know, it seems like that was a successful project. I believe it's one of the 485A recipients, but don't quote me on that. I'm sorry if it's not. It got some kind of tax breaks. I don't know exactly what. It probably got the choice, to be honest, because they're owner-occupied. But, you know, when that building got done, three other developers had already gone bankrupt trying to get that building over the finish line to be apartments that someone could own. So, you know, yeah, that guy succeeded and it was good. And the work he's doing is great too, downtown Dutton's work. But it's not easy. And if it were, lots and lots of people would be doing it. You know, where there's money to be made, people are doing that. And so it's challenging.
Okay. What do you make of the debate on this program on Monday over the term luxury? Because that is a term that comes up a lot. And it is a term that some developers self-identify with when they create new housing developments. I get that. So on one hand, you had Matt Druin saying, not everything is luxury just because it's $2,300 a month or whatever. If you go to New York City, if you go to San Francisco, this would never be luxury. But on the other hand, you had the tenants union saying, excuse me, $2,500 a month is luxury, no matter what you want to call it or what it looks like.
I think I said this explicitly when I was sending you a note about this, that I'm uncomfortable with letting people self-identify what they have. I mean, obviously, it's a thing you do, right? I mean, if I owned a pizza shop, it would obviously sell the best pizza in town. Do you trust that pizza shop to have the best pizza in town? Like, how much weight do you put on their claim that they have the best pizza in town? Similarly, if a developer calls, I mean, the way it came up was about a developer calling their own stuff luxury, right? But imagine if some developer, imagine, you know, some hypothetical developer, Gary Laser, built a new apartment building and he said it was affordable on the website. Does that make it affordable? Affordable to who? I don't think people would let that claim stand on its own. You know, if it's $3,000 a month for apartment, it's affordable for someone, surely, but it's not affordable for a broader spectrum of the population.
But I think that's what the tenants union is saying, Matt. I think what they're saying is, it doesn't matter if you call it luxury or if you don't call it luxury. When you've got $2,500 a month apartments, that's out of the range of most people. We're going to call it luxury.
I mean, I guess that's fine. I just don't think that they should be called luxury on account of the developers.
What's luxury to you?
I mean, that's challenging. I mean, I will confess that I moved back here from being in New York City for a decade, and none of the new buildings, which I'm in all of them, if only to kind of scout out competition, right? None of them are luxury in the same way as new actual luxury buildings in New York City. But and the same thing goes on down there, though. Every apartment building that opens in New York City says it's luxury on the – it doesn't matter what the rents – I mean, the numbers are different, right? It's these brand new apartments opening in the Bronx that are eye-popping are $2,600 a month for a 600-square-foot one-bedroom apartment that just got listed. They call themselves luxury, too, and they're not, right? I think it's just a kind of term to put on stuff. Ryan Holmes calls their new houses in Henrietta luxury. But if you go look at them versus the stuff getting built, you know, off of Clover in Pittsburgh, they're not comparable, even though both of them say they're luxury.
Okay. The point that I think is fair here is that it's contextual. Rochester is not New York City. Rochester is not San Francisco. Call it what you want. The question is, do we need more housing? And later in the program, I got an email from a listener named Andrew who said he used to kind of drive around Rochester and say, man, the last thing we need is more high-end housing or more expensive apartments or more luxury apartments. But he's changed his view because his feeling is the more of these things we build, the more there's going to be a need to get people in them, to get some rents going, and that will bring prices down. Do you agree with that?
Generally speaking, basic economics would have us believe that more of a supply of something will mean that it is less expensive overall.
Does it work that way in this case?
Yes and no. Sorry to be equivocal on it. The issue that Rochester has is that what is affordable, what would be affordable to large portions of the population exists below the replacement cost of the housing that's already here. And that's one of the biggest problems.
Can you say that again? This is an important point.
Sure.
And be as specific as you can here.
So the issue, again, if a new apartment is just a made up number, is $100,000 to produce, the rent that you get for that apartment on an existing unit in Rochester is some fraction of that. That, yes, generally speaking, more supply brings prices down, but the existing supply is below the replacement cost, which creates real issues. In a place where prices are through the roof, somewhere like Portland, if Portland, Oregon built 100,000 more apartments this year, rents would actually come down because the cost to build that apartment is lower than the actual income coming from it. That there are economic rents being collected by developers, owners, everyone in Portland who already owns things. You could build a new apartment in Portland for cheaper than what the rent you could get for it at a market rate is. Here, we're straddling that line. Only the fanciest new units are even coming close to actually covering their replacement cost.
Okay. Let's work through this in several ways then.
Sure.
What does that mean for the current supply, and what does that mean if we continue to build more units like this?
We need to keep building units, especially in the city, because...
Why? Explain why. If population's not growing, why do we need to keep building units?
Sure. While the overall absolute population is not growing in the region, at all times, demographics are shifting against the count of units you have. So I don't remember if we've talked about this on the radio one of the other times I was in or not, but at its height in 1959... early 60s, when Rochester was at its peak, it had 330,000 people living in it.
Yeah.
Since that time, from that year to now, 60 years
yep.
later,
yep.
There are only minus 3,000 units of housing in the city. So the net loss of housing units in the city is only 3,000. That at the time, there were about 93,000 units of housing in the city, and now they're about 90. Those aren't the exact numbers, but it's
right
around that.
Okay.
It's about a net of minus 3,000 over that 60 years. The city is down almost 130,000 residents. Those 130,000 people didn't live in those 3,000 units. They were not 40 people to a house.
So what happened?
Less people live together than they used to. Families are smaller. You don't expect your children to live with you until they get married and leave the house. People
There's
have
a little bit of a
apartments.
Trend back towards living at home longer.
Certainly from an economic perspective, there is. There's more of a trend back to that. But at the same time...
You're talking about 50, 60 years ago. It's still a marked difference.
Exactly. Similarly, you don't expect a couple to stay together through whatever their differences are. People are able to get a divorce. They don't live in the same house after they do that. And so... there's demand for more units of housing, even with the same population. It's not huge. It's not like we need hundreds of thousands of units a year or something like that. But the county of Monroe, so Rochester and the county,
yeah.
generate about 1,500 units of housing a year. About half of those are in the city, almost exclusively in the form of multi-unit rental buildings, and about half of them are in the suburbs.
What do you mean when you say generate 1,500 units?
So every year, 1,500 new units of housing are built in Monroe County. It's been incredibly stable for almost 20 years now that
okay.
about 1,500 new units are built. And as I said, in general, about half of them are in the city and half out.
All right, math here, but let me back up here. 1,500 new units a year. Is that new units? Is that net units? Is there a loss of units? What happens?
There are not good numbers on the net. I would assume, just based on the amount of houses that the city is tearing down a year, which is into three figures, that it's a much smaller net. That between in neighborhoods that are getting richer, deconverting, so many duplexes in the Wedge and in Highland Park and in Cornhill are being turned back into single family homes. As well as the removal of old units, that in fact, at least in the city, it's probably very little unit growth. In the suburbs, I think it's a little different. I don't think Webster is losing a lot of units a year, even if they're building 300 new houses there.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Now, when you look overall at the number of units, I understand that compared from 1960 to today, there's a different need for the number of housing units, even with a different population number. But how do you figure out what the actual need is, if we are even close to it, and what direction we should be going with that?
That's a really difficult question. But if rents are going up, you're not producing enough housing.
If rents are going up
at the top of the market, you're not producing enough housing. Most North American cities, I mean, one of the reasons we have a housing crisis nationwide, not just in Rochester, is because most places are underproducing the amount of housing that they need to stabilize the housing costs. I'm so sorry.
Is that your phone from across the room?
That's my iPad in my bag that I don't even know how it's on the Wi-Fi here, and it's ringing in my bag.
Your iPad is like just across the room. I'm not even sure listeners heard it, but now they know.
Now they know it's ringing.
And by the way, it's like maybe twice a year that happens.
And it's always me. I'm sure it's always me.
It's only been you, and I can't believe we let you back. Look at him. He's going to get the iPad. It's okay. It's all right. I just don't take the call, please. Just wait to take it. Wait to take it.
No, I'm going to turn it off.
Okay, cool.
Look, I printed out all of the stuff I needed the iPad for because I was concerned it wouldn't work, and now it's working all too well.
Very too well. Okay. So we're not going to be sure exactly what we need, but if costs are going up, if rental prices are growing up on average.
If rents at the high end of the market are still going up,
yeah.
If rents at Tower 280 are allowed to continue climbing every year, that they're... And they're fascinatingly higher now than they were when the building opened a few years ago. If they're able to continue climbing, it means not enough units are being produced at the top because those units, in fact, do exceed the replacement costs. That Konar builds, you know, continues building apartments over by Strong, and they're rented out at a market rate, whatever that is, and they aren't seeing that they can't rent them out. All of them are filling up before the buildings open, and they're renting out for the amounts that they're trying to get. If they weren't renting out, or if they were having to lower their rents to fill them, then we would have a fairer idea that we were closer to how much we should be producing.
I've got more math questions. You ready?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Talking to Matthew Denker, the owner of Labeled Living, area median income,
yes.
AMI, is a figure, is a term that we hear a lot. And what I want people to just sort of first understand about what AMI is, it's the midpoint of the region's income distribution. It's not the mean, it's the median. So meaning half of the households in a given region would be earning more than the area median income, half would be earning less. A household's income is calculated by its gross income, which is the total income received before taxes and other payroll deductions. If we took all of Monroe County,
yes,
that AMI would be different than if we just took only the city of Rochester. Right?
It absolutely is. I, in fact, have a handy printout of all of that right here.
And here's why I ask. This is a number that seems pretty malleable to me. And how do you figure out a fair AMI when we're trying to figure out what affordable means for housing and how policy should reflect that?
Sure. It's really challenging. I mean, on one hand, there's a really explicit definition of what AMI you're getting federal funding for when you're doing a project, which is an open disagreement whether that's an okay number, because that is 60% of the defined HUD AMI, which is for Monroe County, not for the city.
County, not city.
Correct.
Shouldn't it be for the city, by the way?
That's going to be a thing to take up with HUD and not me.
I'm not taking it up with you. I'm just saying, doesn't that exclude a lot of people?
Yes. Hands down.
Okay.
It does.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. There's no way around that, at least as far as the current definitions are, that are kind of above our pay grade, if there's a good way to put it.
So what's the AMI in Monroe County?
So, you know, the AMI varies by household size, which is another important thing to keep in mind. But just for a single person household, the AMI for the county is $56,200. That is the defined amount for 2021, which means units to be affordable, considered affordable at 60% AMI, which is the threshold wherein a whole bunch of money becomes available to generate those units. The income limit for a single person is $33,720, And it translates directly to $843 a month in rent, which I also have a sheet here for.
Okay. That's a lot of numbers. So now what I would like you to do is just take us through when we talk about AMI and how it translates, how we come up with that number, and whether a designated affordable housing, you're right, anybody could say anything about their business or about their housing, but what truly is affordable?
Sure. I think defining what truly is affordable, I mean, what is truly affordable is for any one person, what is affordable for them, right? I mean, in some ways it is person by person. The city has been pushing very hard for inclusivity of units at 30% AMI. One of the things that I'm not entirely clear on.
Hold on.
Sure.
The math light in my brain. 30% AMI.
Yeah.
Is what's considered low income, right? So tell me if I'm wrong on this. Households less than 80% of AMI are considered low income. Less than 50% are considered very low. Less than 30% are considered extremely low income households, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay, that's according to HUD. Those are federal standards. And so, again, I just want to say, if we take just the town of Pittsford and came up with an AMI for Pittsford, the area median income for Pittsford would be much higher than it would be for the city of Rochester.
Yes.
Okay? And then if you're basing rents based on, you know, low income for Pittsford, would be very different than Rochester. That's why when you take all of Monroe County, instead of just saying so much of the action's happening in Rochester, but we're factoring in everything in Monroe County, I think we're probably still excluding a lot of people.
It's true. Although I do think that door swings both ways, and I think that's part of the reason for the countywide definition, because you're right. What would be the AMI in Pittsford significantly higher? And I have to tell you, I'm not entirely sure that the people of Pittsford would be thrilled about a whole bunch of 60% AMI units in Pittsford, but it's not 60% for Pittsford. It's 60% for the county, right?
Right,
so
right.
I don't know that there are a whole lot of $840.
That's not conjecture. Generally speaking, it's not a popular thing in Pittsburgh. Yeah.
So, you know, while it is failing the extremely low-income housing needs in the city, this definition, I think it's got a dual purpose, and there is value to having households that can only afford $843 a month renting in Pittsford that I think that is still increasing a certain amount of, I hesitate to say diversity, but the mix of incomes in Pittsford is being materially affected by having to have those affordable units there too.
Let's come back to the $843 a month, because listeners, maybe ask yourself, is your rent or your mortgage $843 or more? $843 is based on what?
That would be 60% of AMI, and it's for a one-person household in Monroe County.
And that's deemed to be what you should be able to afford if you're at 60% AMI?
Correct.
Okay. And that, by the way, is for a person who's deemed to be low income, because low income is 80% of AMI or less, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you think the average low-income person in this city can afford $843 a month?
So the numbers are definitely different for in the city, although they're striking and disturbing in their difference as to the race of the head of household. For better or worse, head of households that are headed by a white head of household can afford nearly the exact same thing as the county, and ones who are not cannot.
Say that again.
So 60% of AMI in the county would be an affordable one-bedroom apartment for one person would be $843.
Yep.
The 60% of AMI for white households, sorry, it's very specific, the definition of this, so I don't want to twist it too much. Where the head of household is white.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's census data, so yep. You've got to go on that.
Yep.
The makeup of the household's not known or exact. It's based on the head of household. Households with a white head of household, 60% of AMI would be $728 a month for an apartment. And for a black or African-American head of household, it's $408. And for Hispanic, it's $399. Is the same. That's the gulf that exists there.
It's incredible. Now, just to be clear also, $843 is 60% AMI, right?
Correct.
30% then would be $422 a month, right?
Correct, yep.
Okay, so $422 a month is what they say you should afford, be able to afford if you are at 30% median income, which is considered by HUD to be extremely low income households. How many units are available for $422 a month in the city?
That I do not have a number of.
Do you think it's a lot?
I suspect it's very few in 2021.
So that means our housing stock for extremely low income is awful and it doesn't exist. What do we do about that? What should happen?
I mean, that's the role of government in all of this.
Subsidy.
It has to be subsidy. There's no market rate way to produce an apartment, a unit, a house for that number. So just to go through kind of the stack of all of this, which I think we discussed a little bit in email, the general rule of thumb is that $1 of rent can support $100 of construction. That's not exact, but it's a great like starting rule of thumb. So if your rent could be $422 a month, that means you could build a $420,000 apartment. Just based on the absolute cheapest that I, or from what I can tell, anyone could do it, which is not what it costs to produce these units. If that would give you a 281 square foot unit apartment. And I don't know that you could physically build 281 square foot apartments in a functional way for people.
All right, hold that thought. Lisa in Rochester, we're going to take your call in a second. But this is the key to the discussion for me here. What you are telling us is 281 square feet?
Yes.
Would be the unit for a developer to be able to afford it to cover the cost?
Correct.
For someone who is at 30% AMI?
Yes.
And that's countywide AMI.
Countywide.
We don't have a Rochester AMI that could then say, hey, by the way, it's not even $422 a month. It's probably half or two-thirds that.
Well, I mean, I have the AMI for the city. I mean, the city's AMI.
I'm just saying HUD doesn't use it.
No.
Nobody
they
uses
don't use it. No.
But what's the city's AMI?
$35,590.
Which is... compared to what's the county AMI?
56,000.
Yeah, so it's two-thirds.
It's basically the city's AMI starts at the 60% rate of the county.
Yeah, it's two-thirds. So low income, extremely low income for Rochester would not be $422 a month. It'd be around $300 a month.
Yeah, 267 is the number I have calculated.
267. Okay, how many housing units in Rochester are $267 a month? Now we're close to none.
I suspect zero.
Zero.
At this point.
Zero. So without help, if you're extremely low income, you got nothing. If you are at 50% AMI, now we're up around $450 a month. You're still got almost nothing in the housing stock that you, quote, should be able to afford. And if you're at 80% AMI, now we're up around $600, $650 a month. Maybe you get something there. There's housing stock there.
There's definitely apartments available at $650 a month.
So yeah. And they're saying that that's what you should be able to afford. But those numbers don't count for the way that HUD and the way that these projects get sort of calculated. So it's sort of a fake number. Okay. I'm being a little...
I know. It's okay. It's true.
It's true.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's no developer. So the point that Matthew is making is if you're a developer, even out of the goodness of your heart, if you say, I don't even need to make a profit, I just need to cover my costs, and I want to make housing that's market rate for people who are extremely low income, that's going to be 200 square feet apartment. It doesn't exist. Can't exist.
It would be very challenging to have an apartment that met those. So there's no legal statutory minimum to apartment size. But generally speaking, the geometry of an apartment based on clearances and required building code and things limits you to about a 400 square foot apartment.
Oh yeah, it's
it
a
would
tiny
be
house.
Challenging would, to build one smaller than that.
I would never want people to live in 200. I'm just pointing out the math here doesn't add up for developers to build these kinds of units without significant subsidy or help. That's one of the reasons why it sounds like you're at least in favor. Is that partially why you're in favor of 485A? Is that related?
No. Well, and again, I didn't come on here to support 485A.
Do
I
you support
be explicit
485A?
I guess. I think
not like full throatedly.
It's tough. I think it's done good work at getting buildings converted. I don't think, and I think I said this to you in the email, the way the tax break works in that it is excusing you from the increased value of what you've done to a building, I think is an incredibly fair way of doing it. That you would not, there's not a good way to capture that excess value right away with taxes, and that it gets a project over the finish line and lets it stabilize. So I think that's good. I also think that the program has had real issues with corruption, not necessarily in Rochester. I don't have a specific example here
Buffalo,
to point to.
There's been some high profile ones.
There's been some really big problems in Buffalo. And so I'm really sympathetic to that set of arguments too. Anything that's open to, you know, being a boys' club situation where it's only available to really large developers who have made really large donations, I have challenges with that. So I can see that kind of argument against it. But I think from a structure standpoint, it's good. And actually, I have to say, I'm not overwhelmingly in favor of the reforms that are being added on to it, because they absolutely are the kinds of reforms that drive up the cost of providing that housing even more in an attempt to do other things at the same time.
Okay. Sorry, Lisa. Hang there for one more minute. Explain what reforms to 485A, which, according to the mayor-elect, have been designed to fix some of the problems he saw to make housing more accessible. What do you see happening here?
So who builds the housing doesn't change the accessibility of it. It changes the pricing, which, so if you're going to add a DBE requirement to something, that doesn't actually change the cost of the contractor. So there are plenty of incredibly capable DBE subs.
DBE is?
Disadvantaged business enterprises. So minority-owned business enterprises, yeah. Veteran-owned business enterprises, women-owned. There's plenty of perfectly capable subs. Their work isn't somehow more expensive. And this is not me trying to somehow not have a DBE on a project. That's insane. What it does add, though, is a level of oversight and an incredible amount of overhead towards having lawyers certify the amount of hours and dollars that have gone into a project, and that those numbers match what you said you would do. That if I say 20% of my construction project will be to a WBE, that there is an entire layer added of certifications to guarantee them doing what I said I'm doing, which on one hand, trust but verify, and I'm sympathetic to that argument. But if you're trying to reduce the costs of housing, adding costs to the housing isn't the way to do it. You know, if you suddenly said that all new housing had to have granite countertops, that's not going to somehow make it cheaper to make that housing. It's a real challenge, and we know that this is a thing that's been done explicitly over the years too. There is a reason that houses needed to get hardwood floors to qualify for mortgages 70 and 80 years ago, that was part of the entire orbit of institutional racism that was done over the course of decades to segregate the housing market. That there was a reason that houses in the suburbs have hardwood floors.
Hardwood floors?
Yeah. Because it drove up the cost. The idea was to create a floor where certain people could afford it.
I see.
And certain people couldn't.
Yeah.
Wherein the people who could afford it were a very certain type of people, and the people who couldn't afford it were a very certain different type of people.
I got you. Okay. Let me get Lisa in Rochester, who's been waiting on the phone. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi. So I made a comment yesterday about in the city needing subsidies to be discussed first before the, let's call it luxury apartment subsidies are discussed. And the reason I said that is because for some mistaken reason, I thought the question we were trying to answer is how do we address our severe housing shortage in the city? And though it will be really helpful for the city to increase its income so that it can provide services to its extremely poor residents, it won't solve the housing problem. Deep, deep subsidies are necessary even for the not-for-profit developers who are trying to build affordable housing and work really hard at trying to scrounge up any money that's out there to build housing. But as your guest is saying, the cost of building, especially with, you know, additional and important accessibility requirements, exceeds what they can charge in rent. And if you do the low-income housing tax credit, that sunsets after a period of time, and the developer, after, you know, building or rehabbing the buildings, can then opt out of that. They can sell their building. They can do all kinds of things that causes that, you know, the benefits of that subsidy to be really short-term. And so I wish the discussion would let us know what's the problem we're trying to solve. If we're trying to provide more housing in Monroe County, that's a completely different issue and has all kinds of equity implications for, you know, who's allowed to live where because of traditional redlining and zoning laws and things like that. If we're talking about providing appropriate housing stock in the city for very low-income people who have basically been trapped in the city, that's an entirely different question. And we need to, in this discussion, understand the needs of seniors in this community, that we've got one of the oldest populations in the state in Monroe County. And those seniors often are women who are on SSI, which is, you know, like $776 or something like that a month. So if you aren't going to discuss what Section 8 will pay and how few subsidies there are under Section 8, how much the county will pay if somebody's on public assistance, and you know that kind of thing, we can't discuss how do we address the housing shortage for low-income people, including seniors.
Yeah, there's a lot there, Lisa. And Matthew, the first thing she's asking is, what problem are you trying to solve here?
Oh, man, I don't know if I'm exclusively trying to solve a problem myself. I wanted to just kind of talk about how challenging this is. I mean, here's the thing. You could attack this from the other direction, right? You could say, all right, there aren't going to be any subsidies for building low-income housing. All the housing is going to be built market rate, and we're going to change it so that, in fact, Section 8 or some sort of rental assistance program just pays market rents, wherein the market rents do meet or exceed the replacement cost of the housing, right? I mean, that would be a different option. There's nothing stopping us from doing that. I think it'd be okay. It's just different money in different places, right? I mean, one of the things that I went through all the way down here is just imagining that we could build this 281 square foot apartment for a second here. To build the same 937 square foot apartment that you could afford at the county AMI, it would be $98,000 worth of subsidy. That's per unit to do that.
$98,000 per unit.
Yeah. So if you wanted to go build, you know, 100 units, it's $10 million in subsidy on a 100 unit building. So it's not a small number. Mm-hmm. It multiplies out very fast. And again, that's for county AMI. That's not for the city or anything. I mean, you could give the subsidy there, or instead you could just say, all right, we're not subsidizing the construction of anything. We're going to just go build market rate stuff, and instead we're going to pay $1,400 a month for that same apartment, which is what the rent actually is based on AMI. You could go that route too. I don't know, what's that? How many months of rent does $1,400 a month get you out of $98,000? It's going to be. Trying to do this in my head. I'm sorry.
No, you see, there's too much math. Actually, while Matthew finishes that thought, we're way late for only break. We're going to take the break now. We're going to come back. We're going to finish this. And I'm going to try to answer Lisa's point on what are you actually trying to do here? Because I do think that we should outline that. And then before we wrap the hour, there's a few more questions for Matthew. As we try to understand the numbers behind development, housing, the reality of the challenge of creating what is truly affordable, not just a slogan, but affordable for everybody in the community, where the median income in Rochester is very different than the average median income in Monroe County as a whole here. We're right back with Matthew Denker, owner of Labeled Living. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we bring you two conversations with local veterans on Veterans Day. First, when members of the military leave active duty, they may face challenges re-entering civilian life. We talk about a program aimed at easing that transition. In our second hour, a 1983 bombing in Beirut took the lives of more than 240 U.S. service members, including three local Marines. We sit down with one of the survivors. Talk with you Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I appreciate Lisa's phone call and some of the feedback from listeners. And I appreciate people hanging in there with us, because when Matthew Denker reached out to me, he kind of was indicating, well, this is going to be a little wonky, and he likes the wonky stuff, but it can be a little dry. But the fact is, most of us, me included, don't always understand this very well. When we talk about housing policy, if we don't understand the numbers and how it works, it's very hard to criticize or come up with ideas for what's going to work here. Lisa is asking Matthew, what's the goal here? I think the goal is pretty simple. More housing stability, not less. There are too many people who move, change addresses in this city, especially, but in the county, on an annual basis, often because they can't afford rent, something happened with a landlord, they're thrown out, et cetera. I want more stability. That would be the goal that I would set. Does that make sense to you?
I think it's a great goal. I think a side goal, which is in some ways related, the city doesn't have a shortage of housing units per se, or rents would be really, really going up. I mean, they are going up, so obviously there's some kind of shortage, but it's not a huge shortage. What it lacks is a lot of safe and, as you pointed out, stable housing. You know, for me, one of the goals would be to have houses that are, in fact, you know, lead-free and asbestos-free.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that I personally have given up on renovating anything is that to do a proper renovation of a home, to properly abate it and insulate it correctly and all of those things, also exceeds the replacement cost of that unit. And so lots of the people who are doing that are not necessarily going all the way, are not replacing all the wiring in a house, are not doing all of those things when they go and renovate a house.
Not safe.
So, I don't want to say any of them are explicitly unsafe. I mean, I think a lot of stuff is overbuilt too, as far as safety goes at times. But, you know, it's difficult to be the guy arguing against additional fire safety too, right? I mean, people ask, like, why is housing more expensive? There's all kinds of things. I mean, not only do houses have air conditioning now, but they also have smoke detectors in every room, and they're wired together, and you've got arc fault breakers in your circuit box now, and all of that marginally adds to the cost of housing in a way that you didn't worry about even 50 years ago. You know, you're not going to open up a circuit box from even 1984 and discover a whole bunch of arc fault breakers.
Okay, but Lisa's also, I think, directing me to kind of help sum this up, at least from my perspective, and I'd like your critique here. What I think I'm hearing from you is, when we talk about labels, whether it's luxury or affordable, they don't really mean anything. There are low income standards, extremely low income standards that HUD has. But when we want to evaluate what's working in a city like Rochester or in a county like Monroe, there's a lot of kind of flippant conversation about, well, developers, just pay out of pocket. If you're going to make money anyway, you got this other project, you're going to make money. And I think what I'm hearing from you is it's extremely difficult for developers to pay out of pocket and create anything that is truly affordable at the lower ends without subsidy, that the government is probably not subsidizing housing enough in that way. And that at the very least, you do see a lot more risk than maybe some of maybe the folks from the tenant union who were critical of developers on Monday on this program. Is that fair?
Yeah, we have. I mean, there's a very strong survivor bias. The developers who are here and are successful and are working are highly visible and are successful. Although I would posit that some of it is shifting of accounting, that someone like Galena or Buckingham or Graywood, a lot of their money is being made market rate on, say, office parks, out in the suburbs, and that they are not necessarily making a whole lot of money on a given project in the city, that some of those projects are not entirely profit driven in the same way that building a new office park or a new subdivision somewhere, you know, Graywood makes a lot of money building subdivisions in Georgia, right? Which is fine. I don't begrudge them for doing that, but they're not making money on the projects they do in the city. So
even so-called luxury housing in the city?
Yeah, that they're doing that either at a loss or at a break even to do it just as, I don't know if for show is the right way to put it, but that they are not making a bunch of money on their projects in the city and they're making more money on projects outside of the city.
Okay. I think it probably surprises people to hear that even the higher end housing the apartment complexes in Rochester, the newer ones, what, the Tower 280? Is that profitable?
At this point, yes.
Got to be, right?
I mean, I don't have access to the numbers, so
you gotta assume.
They could call in and tell, you know, whatever, the new Morgan from Pennsylvania could call in and be like, no, you know what you're talking about, we're not making any money. But based on where their rents are at and what they spent on the building, they should be making money.
Is that project an exception versus the rule?
Ooh, I don't know. There's not a, as much as people say, oh, there's all this new construction going on, there's not that many new projects. I mean, there's only, I went and looked, in the 20 years of this century, there are only 943 new buildings in the city. The city has over 100,000 buildings in it. Less than 1% of them are from the last 20 years. It's not a huge sample size. And I know a number of buildings are not necessarily making a whole lot of money, even for some big name developers. Because one of the other things that I kind of had an issue with on Monday was that this idea that, oh, because you get the tax break after the fact, you would have done the project without it beforehand. And that's just not, it's not how it works. I mean, when you set up one of these projects, you've got, I mean, technically you've got a spreadsheet, but when you're putting together a pro forma, which is what's called of the income and the expenses of a project, all of that's accounted for. It's not like you start the project and, you know, you can go to a bank and be like, well, I've got $1 million coming to me in 6 months, and they'll understand that. I mean, you might discount it. You might say, well, there's a 80% chance that you've got $1 million coming to you in 6 months, at which point it's only worth $800,000. You know, you can apply a discount rate to stuff, and someone might say to me, Matt, well, that's not how it works. Either you get $1 million or you don't, right? It's either 100% or zero. But that falls into the same category of, like, there's only two successful endings to an airplane flight. Like, either you land or you crash. So there's a 50% chance of you crashing every time. We know that's not how it,
right,
how it works. The fact of the matter is some of the risk in development is that sometimes you do get the money you were expecting to get for a project, and sometimes you don't. And you do eat it on the ones that you don't. I mean, it's just kind of how it is. And that's why you have to do enough of them and have, you know, you're trying to beat the odds.
Preston writes to say, Evan, thanks for bringing up the AMI issue. It's one of the reasons I wish City Council had deferred a vote on 485A last night. I think a case could have been made for amending the legislation. Another issue I wish could have been discussed is what the safeguards are on enforcing the affordability factor over the long term. Can anyone answer that? What's been our track record? I think what Preston is asking is, if we deem something affordable housing, is that a fixed rate that someone can stay in, or does, after 3, 5, 7, 10 years, can, because if, let's say, labeled living builds 20 units and the require and X amount are luxury, and how many would have to be, quote, affordable?
I mean, if we're going on the 80-20 rule, if it was a 20-unit building, there'd be four of them.
So,
I mean, but that's a self-chosen number. I mean, the city could just as easily come back and say, well, if you're going to build a new apartment building, it needs to be 90% affordable and only 10% of them.
Okay, they're not doing
rate.
That.
They're not.
They're not. They could.
Yeah.
They're not doing that. But let's say there's 4 out of 20 that are affordable, which means, by the way, that the 16 out of the 20 you need to get higher rents on than you would normally, right?
Yeah. Generally speaking, when you look at something like... I'm sorry, I'm blanking out. Not inclusive zoning, but in any event, when you look at that sort of rule, that the most people being the people getting most squeezed are the ones in the middle. That the other units are going to be more expensive than they would have been otherwise to cover for the lost rents from the affordable ones.
So maybe the people getting squeezed are around $1,500 a month, $1,400 a month, as opposed to $2,500. Or on the extremely low side, right? Okay, that in this city, at least. So I think what Preston wants to know, though, is those 4 units that are now deemed affordable based on what?
I don't know what the city is using for definitions.
So there's different definitions, right? If it's the HUD definition of Monroe County's AMI and it's only low income, it would be 80% of county low AMI instead of extremely low for the city, which is a very different number. Right?
It's true. Yeah.
Very different number.
Because the 485A is administered at the local level, is my understanding. I think, although I could absolutely be wrong here. I think the city has a lot of control over what the definition of what affordable is.
Okay.
But I also don't know what they've chosen.
Point being, affordable could mean a lot of different things, and it's kind of a bunk term. However, Preston wants to know, whatever that number is, whatever you're getting per month from those four affordable units, does that only have to be for 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, or is that in perpetuity?
I don't know. That's also a thing that's up to the city.
Isn't that a fair concern, though?
It is.
That we're going to sunset this thing.
Well, my assumption, which also could be wrong, is that it would be very challenging to enforce those affordability rules past the sunsetting of the 485A itself.
Which is
so that
8 years.
You were out of the program.
Well, no, it's 12. Like 12.
It's so 12 years. Right. It's 8 years of nothing, but then 4 years of incrementally more until you get to the full amount.
So 12 years, and then you're saying it would be hard to enforce that. So that may be another reason that we see what is deemed affordable all of a sudden isn't, and people are moving.
I think that's where the city's locus of control, if you will, ends.
Yeah.
That there's very little enforcement mechanism for them after year 12 once you're out of the program. Because any time before that, they could just easily say, oh, well, you've got to start paying taxes on it. Like, too bad. You didn't keep it affordable. Pay the taxes.
In our last 30 seconds, you have convinced me to ask better and more probing questions. And frankly, so has the tenant union and so many others. And I am grateful for that. What do you want to leave with listeners as we continue a conversation about housing that sometimes gets oversimplified?
I think the biggest problem is that a lot of people see a lot of new construction and say, oh, isn't it enough? Don't we have enough of these? You know, isn't this a thing? And I contend that we don't. That we're not at the saturation point for the market here as far as new construction goes, that we or even conversions of old buildings, that we absolutely could be doing a lot more of it. You don't see the same kinds of protests against a new subdivision in Henrietta, which is getting a public subsidy in a completely different way, whether it's extra sewer lines or road infrastructure or just people having to wait in traffic more because they're all going to be in cars, even if a new apartment building downtown allows people to walk. So I just think it needs to be more balanced like that.
I need a crumpet.
Yeah, done.
Matthew Denker is the owner of Labeled Living, which has some new builds on single-family homes, but also behind the Genesee Block Ice Company and Crumpets, the Crumpet Lady, thecrumpetlady.com.
Yeah.
I haven't had a crumpet in my whole life.
We're in 585 Mag this month, too. So
oh, cool.
If I can shill for them also.
I know it was wonky, but this is important. And keep us honest, and let's keep doing this.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matthew Denker. From the whole team here, Emma Ray Stein, engineering today, Megan Mack producing, Evan Dawson saying thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.